Welcome to the Security Analysis Podcast. This podcast explores investment strategies, economics, personal finance, and stock analysis. It features real conversations and analysis to inform, educate, and entertain. Note that nothing in this podcast is investment advice, and it is for entertainment and discussion purposes only. Do your own due diligence before making any investment. Now, on to the show.
On today's episode, myself and Nelson, the Canadian dividend investor, are going to discuss The Snowball, Warren Buffett and the Business of Life by Alice Schroeder. There are really two definitive books about Warren Buffett, this one and Buffett, The Making of an American Capitalist by Roger Lowenstein. Lowenstein's book is excellent, but he wrote it in 1995, and he wrote it without the cooperation of Warren Buffett. He treated it more like a journalist project, and that was a great thing because so few people actually knew anything about Warren Buffett at the time. It was written before Warren Buffett was extremely famous. Only people who knew about investing really knew about Warren Buffett at that point. He wasn't already a national celebrity. The Snowball, in contrast, was written with the cooperation of Warren Buffett. Alice Schroeder covered Berkshire for Morgan Stanley and knew Warren Buffett personally. And with his blessing, she began the project in 2003 and was given unprecedented access to Warren's files, spent time talking with him directly, interviewed all of his close associates extensively, and this was over a five-year period. The book is massive. It's 852 pages, and it's a deep study on Warren Buffett's life. The book is controversial, and we'll talk about that in this podcast. Warren Buffett hasn't publicly criticized it or disavowed it, but Alice Schroeder has commented that the portrayal was difficult for him at times. He doesn't endorse the book. It's not sold at Berkshire meetings, and he appears to have distanced himself from Alice, even though he hasn't publicly disavowed the book. I love the book. I think it's the definitive biography of Warren Buffett. It's filled with incredible life and business lessons. So, Nelson, I know that you've read this before. You just reread it. What did you think about the book on the reread?
Yeah, I think this was either my fourth or my fifth time rereading The Snowball. I'm looking at it here on my shelf, but I'm a Kindle reader, so I read this one on my Kindle. Honestly, exactly. Your summary was great. It is the definitive Buffett book. The detail that it goes into in terms of, you know, the earlier investments, the personal relationship he had, the partnership days, that stuff is just invaluable to anyone who loves Buffett or even loves investing, because there's a lot of investing lessons that are kind of taught at the same time. Yeah, overall, just a fantastic look at Buffett's life. You know, if I was going to kind of give a criticism to the book, and it's not, you know, anything that anyone can change, but I think the book came out in 2008 or 2009. And yep. So so much has happened since then that you kind of feel like you're kind of left hanging, because it's like, man, like, I know there's been so much stuff that's happened with Buffett since. I'd like to read more just about what happened more recently. So I would love to see Schroeder do an update, you know, perhaps maybe when Buffett has passed away. But yeah, that's a really just a small kind of criticism of just a fantastic, fantastic book.
Yeah, agreed. And it would be nice to see some kind of update, because it does end during the financial crisis. And Warren Buffett, to his credit, was one of the most sober-minded people during the financial crisis, who was aggressively buying things and taking advantage of the opportunities that existed at the time, rather than freaking out like everybody else was, because Berkshire was in such great shape. They were in a good position to kind of seize it as an opportunity rather than something, a crisis that they needed to manage.
Yeah. And it would be fascinating too, to just hear about kind of what went on behind the scenes and you know, the conversations Buffett had with Goldman Sachs. I think he bought a big, a preferred share issue with Goldman Sachs. Bank of America, I think he bought as well during that time. And so it would just be really interesting to get his perspective and kind of what happened, you know, whether there's a lot of kind of Sunday night phone calls to Omaha or what, but that would be like, I would be very excited to read something like that. And the financial crisis, you know, the Great Recession was, we're getting up to 15 years ago now. So it happened a while ago.
Yeah. And yeah, he did buy the preferred shares in Bank of America and Goldman. Lehman also approached him before they collapsed and he said no to them. I guess he saw the writing on the wall and understood that they were one of the bad actors that wasn't going to survive. So yeah, it would definitely be cool to get that insight. So this book is extensive. We'll talk about the different phases of his life and the different things that he went through. So I'd say the first thing we should probably talk about is the influence of his father. So what do you think was the key influence of Warren Buffett's father on his life?
I think, you know, the book talks about just Howard Buffett and just he was just a man of moral and principles to a fault a lot of times. Of course, for the people who aren't familiar, Howard Buffett was a stockbroker, and he was a successful stockbroker. And then in the late 1930s, early 1940s, he ran for Congress as a Republican, and he won despite nobody really thinking he would win. And so he went to Washington, and he had some views that were, even at the time, were pretty out there, you know, talking about Roosevelt and how Roosevelt was going to bankrupt America, take America off the gold standard, everything was going to be worthless. Like it was kind of this doomer stuff that, you know, reasonable investors laugh at today, but he had these views. And the, you know, the Snowball talks about Howard Buffett introducing these bills into Congress and losing, like, you know, 421-3, like just getting annihilated on these bills. But he would just keep doing that kind of stuff because he believed in this stuff, and he would really defend what he believed in and try to kind of carry himself the right way. And I think that's the biggest influence that Warren got from his father, was just integrity and kind of being honest to yourself and true to yourself. You know, he talks about the inner scorecard and the outer scorecard, you know, the difference being, would you rather know you're the best at something and have people believe you're not, or have people believe you're good and actually not be good? And he most definitely got the inner scorecard stuff from his father. His father did not care what people thought about him. He just, that's what he believed in, and he acted in that way. So overall, I'd say that's the biggest thing that Warren got from his father.
Yeah, I agree. He definitely really respected his father. And I think that he did get that concept of the inner scorecard from him. His father was extremely principled. His views were out of fashion and he didn't care. He's like, this is what I believe. And that's the end of it. He wasn't trying to pretend he was something he wasn't. He was also a great entrepreneur. So, I mean, to start an investment business. So he basically kind of failed as a, well, I wouldn't say he failed, but the stock market crash of 1929 came along and he was a stockbroker. And then he pivoted more towards the bond side of things. And to do something like that during the Depression is just a very bold move, to do something entrepreneurial during the Depression. And I think Warren probably learned some lessons there.
Yeah, for sure. I think it was 1930 or 1931, which is right around the time Buffett was born. That's it. His dad started the stock brokerage. And like you said, it was government bonds, it was utilities, it was, you know, those were the kind of things that he was selling, these sort of ultra conservative securities that most likely survived the Depression in a much better way than kind of everything else. But you're right, like, whether it was necessity, I mean, it sure sounded like it was necessity, that he just had to do something. And he knew stocks, so he pivoted into opening up his own brokerage. And because of that, the Buffett family was relatively successful during the Depression, where, you know, Omaha farmers and everything, like, you know, rural Nebraska was hit particularly hard during the Depression. So the Buffett family having that, you know, buffer or whatever you want to call it during the Depression, that was incredibly important for Warren. And kudos to his father for, like you said, taking that risk when nobody else seemingly took that risk. It's not like you read a lot of people who who were entrepreneurial in the 1930s and read about how people couldn't afford to eat in the 1930s. So,
yeah,
absolutely. Very, very important.
Absolutely. And I also think that it was kind of key for Warren Buffett to be around some financial industry concepts. Like he read, his father had a lot of investing books. Warren Buffett read those books at a very early age. He would visit, I thought one of the funniest things from the story was when he would visit basically his father's office, and he had two uncles there. One was like a perma bear and one was like a perma bull. And they would debate about what was going on with the market. And that's almost like, even before he read Ben Graham, that seems like very early he's learning the concept of Mr. Market.
Definitely. I mean, the thing that Snowball does a great job talking about is just, you know, Buffett's childhood was just one big kind of money education. And, you know, he's learning about whatever in school, like kind of the rest of, you know, his generation. But he, you know, his father's office, like you said, he'd be in there every day, like talking to those uncles, you know, talking to the customers, father a library of various, like, you know, investment books. And he just read all of them. And he read all of them at like such an early age, you know, that it's really kind of mind-boggling to think about it now. And I think it was fairly obvious to his parents, where it's like, you know, here's Warren, he's 9 or 10 years old or whatever, and he's reading these investment books meant for adults. They probably realized that they had something special kind of going on at that point, because I don't know about you, but when I was 9 or 10 years old, I wasn't reading you know, big thick investment books. I was reading Archie comics.
Yeah, same. I wasn't too into business at 9 years old. So that was, yeah, it's definitely important in his development. He read his father's books, and then he went to the library and he read every book there. And he seemed to have this early interest in it. So that's the other thing. He seems to have a very early interest in making money. Like, he's making businesses. Even as a child, his favorite possession was like a coin counting machine. So what do you make of that? Like, where do you think that comes from? Like, this early desire, like, I want to be rich. Like, and then he had that one book, 1,000 Ways to Make $1,000, and he's starting little businesses. And like, where do you think that comes from?
I mean, my first sort of thought is that it came from, I mean, what I've observed over the years is that there's people who grow up poor, and this becomes this overwhelming, you know, drive to say, like, man, I grew up poor and I hated it, so I want to be wealthy and I want to be successful. But of course, as we talked about, Buffett's childhood was not poor by any means. I mean, like, the family had money. And one of the things that it, and these are just sort of mentioned in the book, but it's like, you know, at one point, Howard Buffett bought a farm because he was convinced that the world was going to go to hell and they needed somewhere to hide out so they could, you know, grow the food that they needed when the economy was going to inevitably collapse. And that just goes to the principles that we talked about his father earlier, where it's like he felt this way and he went far enough to buy a farm because he was so convinced it was going to happen. So the point is that Buffett's family was not poor. Well, then, so where did that motivation come from then, if it wasn't this sort of deep desire to kind of better himself? And it just, I really think it came down to he decided early on that he had a goal of being the richest man on the planet. He was just going to accumulate money, and his childhood was basically I'm going to learn how to make money and then accumulate money. Because I feel like the childhood was almost him learning how to make money. And then his, you know, later teens, when he went to university and that was sort of how to him learning how to invest the money that he made. So I think that was kind of the motivation. But in terms of, you know, why did he want to be the richest man in the world? Maybe growing up during the Depression influenced him, but I don't think it was the Buffett household, you know, money situation that influenced that.
Yeah, and he made a lot of it. Like, and this, like, you know, you think about like kids, they're working minimum wage jobs. They might have a paper route, but Warren Buffett, by the age of 18, accumulated $53,000. And this is in the 1940s when, I mean, saving $50,000 is hard in current times. To do that as a kid in the 1940s is incredible. So he had this knack at a very early age.
Exactly. And, you know, the book talks about him delivering newspapers and the various entrepreneurial ventures that he got into during his teen years. But it was very much, I think, for Buffett, the attraction of newspapers. The book talks about the, you know, there's counting and there's repetition and there's all these things that he really liked in newspapers. But I really think it came down to he looked at the available jobs for a high school student in Washington, D.C., because the family had moved there when his father was a congressman. And he looked at the available jobs and he said, all right, what's the job that I can get that'll pay the most? And I think it was newspapers kind of, you know, on a per hour basis, if you could do it efficiently back then, you were getting paid a lot of money. And I think at one point he had like three or four paper routes. He's doing like the morning one and then the afternoon one and then the evening one. And, you know, he's getting paid sort of what an adult was getting paid back then. He's only like 14, 15, 16 years old. So I think that's why he sort of went for paper routes, was he just looked at it and said, hey, I can make a lot of money doing this. And at that point, he was all about the money. He really didn't ease up on that for a number of years. But I really think that was it. He just looked at what he could make the most money doing.
Yeah, and it's funny how kind of destiny worked out there, because the paper he delivered when he was living in Washington, D.C. was, you know, the Washington Post, and he wound up owning it someday. I thought that was really funny. So we talked about his father. So his father was the more positive. On the other hand, his mother was very overbearing, rough. She would yell at the kids all the time. She would insult them. And then kind of the contrast to that was the person she was in the house was extremely different from the person she was in public. So she was very much like outer scorecard driven, and she was basically like verbally abusive towards her kids. So what do you think was the influence of his mother on his life?
I mean, the Snowball talks about how basically for the rest of Buffett's life, he just ran away from his mother. And he would, like Thanksgiving dinner or whatever, he would go to his parents' place as a young man, when he had a young family. And he would just eat his food and then just immediately leave. Or like immediately, you know, when he had the parents over at his place, just immediately like go upstairs and just avoid his mother. His mother and, you know, the things you talked about, they affected him deeply. I think that they added to, you know, he's very insecure when he was younger. He was immature. He struggled with a lot of things that, you know, a lot of young men struggle with. But it seems like he had a particularly bad, especially in a world where he was sort of hanging out with guys who had been to, you know, the Pacific in World War II. And these guys who had to grow up incredibly quickly. And then you've got, you know, Warren Buffett who struggled to grow up partially because of, you know, he didn't feel safe around his mother. So that insecurity, I think, definitely drove him to be successful, whether it's like the subliminal thing to, you know, kind of show your mother that you can be successful, or, you know, to maybe kind of show her that her influence didn't work and he, you know, grew up as a strong young man. But there's no doubt that it affected him deeply. And I can see why. You know, I mean, I had an extremely loving mother. And it's just, I can't imagine how bad it would be to grow up and just have to fear your mother. You know, that would be I don't even want to think about it. It's not a very nice thing for him to have to go through as a child. So definitely had an influence. But I can't really, you know, sort of measure what that influence was, but it's sad. You just read about it. And it's sad. It to read how he would avoid his mother and how she just would eat away at him and everything. Just really, really sad to to read about.
Yeah, and I think it did basically two things to him. So I think it gave him the streak where he wanted to be independent. Like, it was like, I need to get away from, I don't want to be under someone's thumb who I don't like anymore. I think that's kind of a key motivation there. And then it also, in his early life, he was kind of riddled with self-doubt and insecurity, like you mentioned. So I think that's the main influence of her on his life. It gave him the desire to be, an extreme desire to be independent. And it also gave him some early self-doubt and insecurity.
Mm-hmm.
So with that self-doubt and insecurity, obviously he gets out of that. I think a key way that he did that was the Dale Carnegie course that he took. And he read the book, How to Win Friends and Influence People Early. And then he started applying it systematically in his day-to-day life. Like, I would bet most people who read that book are like, yeah, that's a good idea. And then they kind of forget about it. But he like actually went out and kind of systematically started to apply it in a way that helped him come out of his shell. Do you think do you agree? Do you think Dale Carnegie was kind of a key way that he overcame that?
Oh, absolutely. And like you said, he took this book, he read it, he recognized that he had a weakness, and he set out to make it better. And like you said, most of the people that read that book, oh, hey, this is interesting, this is smart, and they just like throw it aside, and like it just collects dust for the next 20 years. But he read it, he implemented it, he realized that didn't go far enough, so he signed up for the Dale Carnegie public speaking course. The first time, he lost his will and canceled the check. And so then the second time, he went in and gave the guy the check personally and kind of told him to cash it right away so he wouldn't kind of lose his will to go to this course. So it's like this was pretty clearly a fear of his was public speaking and just kind of generally, you know, sort of speaking with people and dealing with people. And he recognized that as a weakness, and he went out and he corrected it. And I think throughout his whole life, he just sort of very kind of quietly improved on these things. You know, there's a story in the book about how if he wasn't happy with, you know, a conversation partner, he wasn't happy with the sort of people at his house, he would just kind of extract himself from the conversation without much tact and just go upstairs and read a book. And you know, throughout his life, he got much better at sort of gracefully extracting himself from these conversations, things like that. And of course, the public speaking, you know, Buffett is a great public speaker. You know, eight hours every year at the Berkshire Hathaway meeting. And I've been to it. I don't know if you've been to it or not, but, you know, the 2015 year I went, it was Buffett was in his late 80s and like Munger was in his early 90s. And just Buffett was up there for the whole day, no problem, speaking about whatever. So it definitely had a influence on his life. And it was even something that would have been like, you know, 55 or 60 years later, he was still using it.
Yeah, absolutely. He's definitely benefited. Kind of the other thing that helped him get out of that, I think, was Susie Buffett. So, you know, he met her and he says about her that she literally saved my life. So how do you think Susie helped him out in improving that?
I think Susie was, you know, he was deeply, you know, the deep self-doubt, the deep self-consciousness. I think he met Susie and Susie was just instrumental in just kind of realizing that Warren had this gift when it came to making money and managing money and just nurturing that gift and just making sure that he felt loved and secure and that, you know, somebody always had his back. And, you know, we talked about Warren's mother and just the difference in personality compared to from his mother to Susie, where it's like Susie just loved him unconditionally, you know, realized that he needed space and realized that, you know, he just needed somebody to tell him that it was, you know, that he was worthy and that everything was going to be all right. Exactly the things that he didn't get from his mother. And so he got that stuff from Susie. And it's no coincidence that he ended up with a woman who was the exact opposite of his mother.
Yeah, I think she was a kind of a critical part of his later success too, because basically he focused on, I'm going to run this partnership and pick stocks and focus all of my time on that. And she basically took care of everything else in his life.
Yeah. Yeah. That's it. And of course, eventually she kind of needs more and, you know, that leads to them sort of growing apart. But in the early years, like, she definitely took care of the things that he just didn't, because he was so focused on the partnership and on making money and on that side of it. And she enabled him to do so without having to worry about, you know, the kids or the house or any of that stuff. She just took care of it. And that was a huge benefit to him, both kind of, you know, like in terms of freeing up brain power for him, but like psychologically too, where he can just sort of say, hey, Susie's taking care of that. Susie's taking care of the kids. And all he had to worry about was his profession. So he took a gift, and then he was able to just focus extensively on that. So you take someone with a gifted personality and then Buffett's work ethic, and you put them together, and really, really special things happen. But Susie was the one that was enabled him to put in the work ethic that he needed to really, really sort of benefit from his gift.
Yeah, agreed. And I think she was major to his life and to his success. So do you think that the portrayal of the marriage in the book is the reason? Well, let me first talk about this. So Warren Buffett, like I mentioned earlier, he hasn't actually come out and publicly disavowed the book, but by all accounts, he doesn't like it. So Alice Schroeder actually commented on this. This is what she wrote. She wrote, "I wouldn't call it a fallout. He made himself extremely vulnerable when he opened himself up to do this book without any control over the content. It was the right decision, and he did it because he knew it was the only way to get a credible book. Then, as you would expect, when he read it, the book did not perfectly match the narrative of his own life that he carries in his mind. That was pretty uncomfortable for him. One of his friends wrote me a letter that said, 'Oh my God, you captured him exactly,' but it was like taking all his clothes off in public. And that's true. So I have a lot of empathy because he made himself vulnerable in a way that I would never do myself. It was courageous of him. The end result is that the book makes him feel uncomfortable. He would rather not think about it. There's no personal issue between us at all. It's pretty comfortable, actually." So do you think that kind of the part that is tough for him to read is the relationship with Susie and the eventual breakdown of his marriage? Do you think that's kind of the key element there?
Definitely, definitely. And I would kind of go a little bit, you know, into more detail, where in the book it doesn't really come out and say it, but it's very much implied that Susie was having an affair with a tennis instructor. And there's also an old boyfriend from high school that she may or may not have been having an affair with. And I think that was the part that really made Buffett uncomfortable, was either disclosing the affair and kind of removing, like kind of knocking Susie down a peg or two. Because like it's very obvious, and as you read the book, that Buffett worshipped his wife, even when she moved out on him, moved to San Francisco, was like, hey, I need a break from Omaha. I need a break from you. Even then, it's like he blamed himself. So he definitely worshipped his wife. And I think that was the big issue, was that Alice Schroeder told it like it happened. And that didn't mesh well with his memory of Susie. And of course, when the book came out, Susie had just died a few years before. So there was that aspect of it. But, you know, whether it was Buffett being naive or whatever, I don't think that he thought the book would delve so far into his personal life. And that made him uncomfortable. And the sort of negative things that were said about Susie, I think, really made him uncomfortable. And I think that was the impetus for, you know, Buffett just kind of say, hey, you know what, this is done. It's out there. I wash my hands of you. I wash my hands of this project. And, you know, by that point, he had the emotional maturity to kind of cut people off without making them, you know, feel like they were cut off. So that's what I think the real discomfort came from.
Yeah. And in Susie's defense, I mean, the marriage, they were already separated. So she was already living in another place. He already, I believe, had the relationship with Astrid, his current wife. So they were already kind of separated. So, and like you said, the book doesn't come out and say she had an affair, but she clearly had a relationship with this tennis coach. So yeah, I can kind of understand where she's coming from, but I also understand it might be hard to for Warren to read about that, particularly after he had just been grieving over her death.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a real messy kind of situation. And of course, Susie was unhappy with, I mean, a lot of people, they kind of sort of step back as they get a little bit older, but the, you know, Warren's in his late 40s, early 50s. She's in her late 40s, early 50s. And he's just, he continues to push. And you know, instead of kind of burying his head in annual reports all the time, he's traveling all the time. And he's, you know, going to Washington Post board meetings. And he's hanging out with Catherine Graham. And he's staying at her place. And there was, you know, the book really leaves it up to the reader to decide whether there was an affair going on with Warren and Catherine Graham. I don't think so. I think they were just, you know, friends and they were close. And Buffett has a history in, I mean, his entire life, Buffett seeks out women to kind of be friends with. So I think that, you know, I don't think Buffett had an affair with Catherine Graham, but from Susie's perspective, it sure looked like he was having an affair. And you mentioned Astrid, where it's like, you know, sort of, immediately after Susie left, you know, she calls Astrid and says, hey, he's a wreck. Go check in on him. And I don't know, it was like 2 months later or something, like Astrid moved in. And, you know, from Susie's perspective, that would be difficult, where it's like, you have this husband who says all the right things and says he worships you. And then kind of the minute you leave, he finds this other woman and he moves her in. So a messy, messy kind of situation. As much as Buffett would have liked to have thought that it was really quite simple, and it's like, yeah, you know, what's the quote that if you knew the people involved, it would all make sense. No, very messy, and he probably didn't like the fact that all those details were, you know, not just the stuff that made Susie look bad, but the stuff that kind of made him look bad too.
Yeah. Do you think it was in poor taste for Alice to go into so much detail about that? Like, I could definitely see talking about the marriage and how it broke down, but to get into the tennis coach and everything else, do you think that's necessary to the story? Was it in bad taste? Was it a key part of Warren's psychological makeup? Like, what do you think? Do you think it should have been in there?
I think that if I was Alice Schroeder and my directions from Warren Buffett were to write the best biography I could. And one of the things that the very beginning of the book where she talks about Buffett kind of giving her instructions on the biography, he said, always use the less flattering version of the story. Whenever you hear two versions of a story, always use the less flattering one. And I think that he told her that, not really sort of envisioning the detail that she would go into in terms of his marriage and his wife's infidelity and that sort of thing. So I think that as a biography, I appreciated those details, because for me, when I read a biography, I find that just about every great person is almost a lesson in contrast, where it's like, here's the things they were absolutely great at, but also here's some things that they're really, really bad at. And I enjoy that contrast. And so from a reader's perspective, I enjoyed it. And I appreciated that those details were in there. But from Buffett's perspective, I mean, I can just put myself in his shoes. And like, you know, if I had my dirty laundry kind of aired out for the world to read about, I probably wouldn't be too happy about it.
Yeah. And I mean, Warren Buffett's a human. Every human being, nobody's perfect. Everybody has, you know, skeletons in their closet and things that were difficult in their life that they may not want to revisit. Nobody's a saint, you know? So I think that if any of us had someone dig into our lives, talk to everyone we ever knew, do extensive interviews with them, there'd probably be some narratives and things uncovered that would be hard to read in a book.
Absolutely. I'm just thinking about, you know, some of the cringeworthy things I did as a youth. And, you know, I just thank God they didn't have cell phone cameras back then. definitely. Like just being the worst parts of your life in print, not easy for a lot of people. And, you know, Buffett from his childhood, the mother kind of, you know, poking at his self-esteem all the time. Those aren't wounds you very easily recover from. And so it might've been even worse for him. The fact that he brought this woman in to write about his life and, you know, gave her sort of unprecedented access. And then after all that, you know, she airs his dirty laundry to the public. No wonder it made him a little bit uncomfortable, even though he told her to. He just, I don't think he thought that she would dig so deep into this stuff. I thought, you know, he probably thought that she would just sort of, hey, there's this Susie Astrid situation. It's kind of weird. Don't worry about it. Let's move on. More business.
Yeah, definitely. So through the book, I definitely get the impression that Warren Buffett really compartmentalizes his life. And he has extreme focus on one area. So we talked about the relationship with his wife. It also seems like early on, he wasn't as focused on his kids because he was just so consumed by investing. It was at the expense of everything else. So do you agree with that? And how do you think that's affected his success and his life?
I mean, definitely. He definitely, you know, the book talks about, he ignored his kids. His kids would kind of come up and, hey, Dad, you want to throw the football around? Hey, Dad, you want to do whatever? He would sing to Susie Jr. every night. You know, he was there, but he wasn't really active and he wasn't really a big participant in their lives. Now, that's partly, you know, it was the 1950s and 1960s. And I don't think fathers were, you know, like I think we're judging a bit in terms of today's standards, on a previous generation, and that really frustrates me just in general. So it was different back then, and dads weren't involved as much. It was like dads went, dads made the money, moms stayed at home, moms raised the kid, raised the kids, and that was it. And so that was much more accepted back then. And I think that as time has moved on, Buffett has definitely made an effort to have a better relationship with his kids, especially after Susie died. You know, Susie Jr., I think now lives in Omaha. My understanding is that he sees his grandkids every Sunday, takes them to Dairy Queen for blizzards. So he's rectified that to a pretty good degree. So it's hard to kind of judge because we don't really know, at least I don't know sort of the attitudes back then, but in terms of the facts, there's no doubt that he was not very involved in his kids' lives. And I think that affected his kids somewhat in terms of they were just sort of kind of left to their own devices. And especially as they got a little bit older, where their mother kind of, you know, started getting more involved in her causes and that. So it was definitely something that happened and he regrets it.
Now, at the same time, while he regrets it and it didn't work out great, don't you think that's kind of a key reason he is who he is and he got as rich as he was? Like, would he have been as monumentally successful as he is if he didn't have that intense focus for such a long period of time?
I mean, absolutely not. Like you're right. He that focus was what made him the richest man in the world. And I mean, I think without that, it's super interesting to think about because it's like, okay, if Warren Buffett, with his gifts, and he works 40 hours a week like the rest of us, where would he have ended up in terms of, you know, would Buffett have been a billionaire without that drive, that deep desire to become one of the richest people in the world? That's a great question. And I'm not sure I can answer that. I do know that the kind of gifts only take you so far. And without that focus, you're likely to just be, you know, pretty good. We all know people who it's like, wow, you're incredibly smart. Like if you just had more ambition, you'd be able to really kind of do something with your life. So I think the drive was every bit as important as his, you know, innate intelligence and the gifts that he had. Without it, you know, is he a billionaire? Maybe. I think he's just kind of another sort of comfortable, you know, 1% kind of guy with a pretty good net worth and he's rich and, and everything. But without that drive, there's no way he is Warren Buffett. He's just another faceless guy in Omaha with, you know, 50 million or 100 million.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree with that. I think he would have been very successful, but to be the richest man on earth definitely takes another level of drive and ambition and focus. So let's go backtrack a little bit. So going back to college, he doesn't want to go to college. His father basically forces him to do it. Then he's applying for graduate schools. He gets rejected from Harvard Business School. At this point, he's already read Ben Graham. He's already read The Intelligent Investor. And then he finds out Ben Graham is alive and well, and he's teaching at Columbia, and he gets into Columbia. So let's talk a little bit about Ben Graham. How important do you think Ben Graham is to Warren's life?
Well, of course, Ben Graham, you know, even to this day, Buffett talks about how Ben Graham was just such an enormous influence. But what I'd like to talk about a little more is sort of the luck that it just so happens to be that Warren Buffett is sort of looking for graduate schools. The fact that he didn't really want to even go to college in the first place, like you said, and then sort of stumbles upon the fact that hey, here's Columbia, and Ben Graham teaches at Columbia. And not only that, but of course, after he completes the security analysis at Columbia, he goes back to Omaha for a bit and then gets a job with Ben Graham and is able to learn under the master for what, like 2 or 3 years, I think, in New York. So to watch him, you know, at work, and it, you know, from the sounds of it, it doesn't sound like Ben Graham was really working that much at that point. He's more interested in chasing women. But to learn from him, to learn from guys like Walter Schloss, who was there at the same time, I think that definitely had an influence on Buffett. It might have had even more of an influence in terms of taking the course, was that be able to hang out with these guys and talk to these guys and learn from these guys sort of directly. A huge, huge, huge benefit for him. And not only that, but just being at the right place at the right time, that, you know, because Buffett only worked for Graham for 2 or 3 years, and then Graham shut down his fund, his partnership. And so Buffett would have come along, you know, 3 or 5 years later. All of a sudden, it's like there's no opportunity to work for Ben Graham, and there's probably not even a chance to take the course from Ben Graham. So he got extremely fortunate to have graduated the time that he did.
Yeah. Do you think there's an alternate universe where Buffett gets into Harvard, and then what happens to him? Do you think he's as successful as he is?
That's a great question. I don't know if he sort of adopts Ben Graham's principles with the same ferocity if he goes to Harvard versus he goes to Columbia. If he goes to Harvard, it very much could have been a situation where he, you know, they recognize that there's some talent there, there's a gift there, and some pension fund or some insurance company hires him to do their investments. And then all of a sudden, it's like a very different sort of path. And who knows what happens at that point. So definitely the Harvard, that'd be really interesting to kind of, you know, I'm not a big fiction guy. One of the fiction books that I do like to read are kind of these alternate histories, of, you know, alternate histories of World War II and things like that. And a alternate history of Warren Buffett would be pretty interesting.
Yeah, it would be. And I think he's still extremely successful because he was already familiar with the ideas of Ben Graham and applying them in his personal portfolio. But yeah, I just wonder what could have been. But yeah, I think Graham was critical to him. But very early on, he deviates from Graham. So Graham was extremely diversified. And then Buffett, early on, he's buying Graham style cigar butt investments, but he's very concentrated in them. And then he also goes beyond that, where he finds something that's not really a cigar butt, Geico. He identifies it early in the 1950s. He goes and he actually goes to the offices and he learns how the company works and operates. So why do you think, so it must have been, I would imagine, like Walter Schloss, for instance, he basically took Graham's style and said, okay, I'm going to do this. Buffett learns it understands it, loves it. But then he very early strikes off on kind of his own path and style. What do you think it is in Warren Buffett that made him do that so quickly?
Well, I think it's that independent streak that we talked about in terms of his father's principles and that. And I think that he identified where it's like, okay, Ben Graham, there's this great kind of this great philosophy that this sort of, you know, it's a winning formula without a doubt. But I think he sort of, in the back of his mind, kind of recognized there were limitations to it. And he's just a young guy who was learning kind of everything he could. And he realized that Ben Graham is really good for this certain type of security. But for this other type of security, which was like 90, 95% of the market, he's really not that good for it. And so Buffett just learned and kind of realized that Graham's methodology had some weaknesses. And so I think that, you know, as a student of business, he was able to kind of identify where it's like, you know, Geico back then was, it was only selling to government employees. Like that's the acronym, you know, GE is government employees. And he just kind of recognized that there's something special there. And when there's something special there, he was just fascinated by it. And that's what kind of drove him to, there's a story in the book where he goes out to the company on a Saturday and just like knocks on the door until someone lets him in and just starts asking questions and just kind of, you know, just wants to learn about this company and about the insurance business. And that was just, you know, like not many other people would do that and kind of have that curiosity. And Walter Schloss, like you mentioned, he figured out what Graham did and then he did it for the next like 50 years. So I think Buffett early on kind of recognized the limitations perhaps of Ben Graham's teachings and perhaps kind of looked at it and said, okay, well, this is a good start, but I need to sort of identify kind of bigger opportunities as I grow. But it wasn't really until Charlie Munger came along that he really, really grasped that.
Yeah. So the introduction of Charlie Munger in the book is very funny. So he's meeting with some potential investors who know Charlie Munger. And then they say, well, you remind me a lot of Charlie Munger. And he says, well, I have to meet this guy. And yeah, I thought that was just a great introduction to him, to the story.
There's a part where when Buffett and Munger first meet, that Munger tells a joke that only he found, I mean, like maybe everyone else enjoyed the joke, but like Munger thinks this joke is so funny that he's just like, he falls out of the booth in the restaurant and is just like rolling on the floor laughing about his own joke. And it's like, what an introduction to Charlie Munger, because, you know, Charlie Munger, a lot of things, but he's definitely very sure of himself. And just what a great introduction to Charlie Munger. What Charlie Munger in a nutshell, really, where it's like he's so encaptured with his own words that he's just killing himself laughing at himself.
Yeah, and it's one of the great partnerships in history. You know, rest in peace, Charlie Munger. He was a genius and very funny and filled with so much wisdom to give the world. So what do you think is the influence? So we've talked about Ben Graham. Now what's the influence of Charlie Munger on Warren Buffett's life?
Well, of course, the easy answer is that Buffett or Munger taught Buffett that the Ben Graham method would never scale. It was always going to be these tiny little cigar butts that works well when you have a small amount of money in the 1950s and the 1960s. I don't think a cigar butt strategy is a winning strategy in 2024, but back then it sure was with small amounts of money. And as Buffett grew the partnership and as he was very quickly getting quite wealthy, Munger was the one who kind of said, hey, this isn't going to scale forever. And it took Buffett a few years to sort of realize that, but Munger was completely right. So that's definitely the sort of the big thing that Munger taught Buffett. But I think that's really understating Munger's influence, because over the years, you know, I think that Munger was almost like an advisor to Buffett, where he could go and he could sort of spitball ideas and they could talk about stuff and just kind of rein in, you know, sort of Buffett's kind of Graham cigar butt tendencies. I think that that over the years, Munger's influence was really as a sobering kind of pricking holes in some of the more kind of outrageous things that Buffett would have liked to do. So just like a older brother almost sort of relationship, and then just in terms of having someone to talk to and everything like that. So everyone will talk about, you know, it's like, this is what Munger did. Munger told Buffett to invest in the great companies, but I think it goes much, much deeper than that. And of course, they had a relationship for what, 60 years until Munger passed away. Like it's just just an enduring relationship that had a massive influence on Buffett, not just buy better companies.
Gotcha. Okay. So Charlie Munger. So we're recording this on the day that the 2024 Berkshire letter just came out. And he actually has a very nice tribute to Charlie Munger in this letter. And he says that Charlie Munger is the architect of the present Berkshire, and I acted as the general contractor to carry out the day-to-day construction of his vision. And he said that in 1965, Charlie told him buying Berkshire was a mistake. And he says, but now that you control Berkshire, add to it wonderful businesses purchased at fair prices and give up on buying fair businesses at wonderful prices. In other words, abandon everything you learned from your hero, Ben Graham. It works, but only when practiced at a small scale. So I thought that was a very nice tribute to him. And yeah, he considers Charlie the architect of the current Berkshire Hathaway.
Yeah, I also read I skimmed it this morning before we came on. And it was a really nice tribute, and that, you know, Buffett really did a nice job of summarizing his friend's influence, even though, you know, Buffett was the one who worked on Berkshire Hathaway. Like, that was his painting, I think he calls it. And Munger was more of the advisor, but Munger's ideas were huge influence.
Absolutely. So when we're talking about cigar butts, so during the partnership, he's working with many different cigar butts. So Berkshire is one of them, and he's kind of struggling with that. Dempster Mill is another. How much of his transition to Wonderful Business do you think was the influence of Munger versus just experiencing the pain of trying to be an operator of these businesses?
Yeah, I'm thinking of kind of myself and sort of my investing journey where, like, you know, I went through sort of a deep value kind of phase, and it's so much easier to own excellent companies. And Ben Graham's methodology, of course, for Buffett was extremely successful, but it came at a price. And I think it was Dempster Mills where he ends up sort of taking control. And you'll have to help me out here because my memory's a little bit fuzzy. Where I don't know if he lays everyone off or he just threatens to lay everyone off. And the town, just the whole town hates him. This town of Dempster, Nebraska, like, I don't know, like 500 people in the town or whatever. And everyone's like hates this guy because he was the one who came in and insisted on some good capital allocation for a change. And so I think those types of things affected him deeply. And when he did take control of Berkshire Hathaway, of course, they had these very antiquated mills. They're making suit linings. And he very much was like, okay, listen, we've got this really shitty business here, but we're not going to do anything with it. We're not going to lay anybody off. We're not going to close it down. We're going to let it continue. And I think some version of the mills of Berkshire Hathaway continued for like 30 years or 20 years after Buffett took control. So it's very obvious that kind of activist investing that he was partly doing in the Ben Graham days affected him. And I think that was definitely an influence to kind of that more quality approach, was that when you buy a quality company, you know, you don't have to make a lot of these really painful decisions. You just sort of have to kind of, you know, operate more on the periphery and kind of like, you know, just sort of influence the ship a little bit rather than take control of the ship and start making major changes. So, yeah, I think that discomfort was part of the factor that caused him to embrace Charlie Munger's kind of quality at a fair price versus, you know, fair at a wonderful price.
Yeah, Dempster was rough for him. And it's a theme throughout Warren Buffett's life, I think, that he doesn't really like confrontations or getting in the conflicts with people. And I think to be that kind of activist investor where you're liquidating things and laying people off, you can't have that in you. You have to be someone who kind of likes confrontation. Like, probably the anti-Warren Buffett is Carl Icahn. So I get the impression from Carl Icahn that he likes going into a company and firing everybody. That's the impression I get from him. But that's not Warren Buffett. Warren Buffett wants to have good relationships with people, I think.
Yeah, for sure. And I think Warren Buffett wants to be remembered as this sort of grandfatherly, nice guy who worked with management and kind of made everybody rich, rather than be remembered as the guy who showed up and started cutting jobs and made his money that way.
Yeah, and I just think getting in the fights with people, like, I mean, he's in the, with Berkshire particularly, he's in this battle with, you know, the management of Berkshire. He goes through a similar thing with, what was the map company? I forget.
Sanborn Maps.
Sanborn Maps, right. So he's getting in all these fights with people because that's what you got to do if you want this investment to succeed. But yeah, I'm pretty sure that that left a bad taste in his mouth. Like, man, I do not want to spend the rest of my life doing this crap.
You know, one of the things that I remember from looking at a lot of the kind of deep value stocks, because like you, I that was my beginning was investing was this deep value kind of cigar butt strategy. And it's like, you look at these companies and it's like the management on these are just so bad so often. And they're there, they're entrenched, they own a bunch of stock, and they're really just there to kind of ensure that they continue to have a job and that they continue to just kind of be big shots at these small companies. And it's difficult to have to fight with these people in order to make some money when there's this alternate path where it's like you can partner with these wonderful businesses and you don't have to like fight with anyone to make money. So I can definitely see it from his perspective, especially knowing Buffett's personality and you know, kind of the damage that his mother did growing up and his desire to be liked and the everything like that. So for sure, just a much easier way to make money. To just avoid these situations forever. And it took him a while, but he figured it out.
Yeah. And so he has some early, I think the earliest experience that he has with a quality company is Geico. But then I also think that American Express was very important. So he buys American Express in a state of extreme distress after the salad oil scandal. But he recognizes the value of the franchise and the economics of it. So how important do you think American Express was to that development?
Oh, definitely. Super, super important. And, you know, the book goes over his kind of research process in American Express. And he really just goes around and, you know, he's like, hey, is this the core traveler's check business? Is the core credit card business? Is this really impacted by the salad oil scandal? And the, you know, kind of the Main Street analysis that he did was like, no, like nobody cared. And so he was able to kind of, you know, use that knowledge and be more confident in investing in it. But I think the really interesting question that this sort of comes up with was like, well, Geico was very successful for him at first. American Express was very successful. And so these early kind of forays into these high quality businesses were successful for him. But what happens if these forays aren't successful for him? What happens if the, you know, the salad oil scandal kind of brings down American Express or brings it down to the point where it took him a number of years to get his money back, like what happened with Salomon Brothers later on in his career. Would that have had an influence where, you know, he might have said, okay, like this clearly isn't working and maybe stuck with a Ben Graham, you know, sort of philosophy? I don't know, but it's interesting to kind of think about. And it's interesting to sort of realize where it's like, yeah, he was very successful doing this right from the beginning. And his life might have ended up different if he just got unlucky with those first few investments.
Yeah, possibly. So, and he took a huge position in American Express. I forget what percentage of the portfolio, but I know it was like, I think it might have been like 40% of the portfolio was in American Express at that time, something like that.
And I think with Geico too, with his personal portfolio, at one point, I think it was like 50% of his personal portfolio or something. Like, you know, this is the early 1950s, maybe mid 1950s, but before the partnerships and everything. So he was definitely willing to sort of concentrate and go out there with these high quality stocks, and it worked out for him. But things might have been different if they didn't.
Absolutely, that's possible. Yeah, and so throughout the 60s, he puts together a incredible track record. He never has a down year. He beats the market every year. He makes like a 30% plus CAGR. His investors have a fantastic result. Then by the late 60s, the market's pretty richly valued, and he quits. And I think a part of it is the influence of Susie. She tells him that sitting in a room and making money is not a life. So what do you think prompted the decision to, you know, quit running the partnership?
Susie definitely had an influence, like you said. I think it was partly too that he's sitting in a room kind of by himself, and he's just like, yeah, he had his value investing buddies, and by then he was talking to Munger all the time, and you know, he had the Buffett group and everything, you know. But it's lonely to kind of sit in a room by yourself, so that factored into it. But I think the biggest part was he had this just incredible track record. And he knew that, like, look, I can't maintain this forever. And I don't think he felt this deep responsibility to his partners much, much more than I think most money managers today would feel towards their partners. And he saw a future where he couldn't deliver what he had delivered kind of the previous decade. And rather than disappoint people, he just quit. And it's kind of a noble thing for him to do, but it's also kind of a perplexing thing for him to do, because it's like, you know, if you just ratchet down your customer or your partner's expectations, it's like, look, like, you know, we might be a few lean years, you know, the market was very expensive when he quit, and that probably had something to do with it as well. So it's a noble thing for him to have done that. But at the same time, it's like, it sort of goes to some of his more deep kind of psychological issues, where it's like he was so scared of disappointing people that rather than risk it, he quit. And then when he did liquidate the partnerships, you know, he gave his partners Berkshire Hathaway stock, because that was a big thing he had invested in. But he didn't really like tell them to hold it. It was just kind of like, hey, here's some Berkshire stock, like do what you want with it. So it was an interesting kind of, it was interesting to realize his kind of psychological state at that point, and just to see how these partnerships affected him and how he didn't want to disappoint people.
So do you think that Berkshire was what it became was by design, that he intended that to be his primary investment vehicle? Because he doesn't mention that into any of the partners. He doesn't say like, you know, hold on to Berkshire. That's going to be my new thing. Do you think he knew, or do you think it just kind of evolved in that direction?
I mean, that's a great question. And I mean, I'm fairly certain he didn't tell the partners to hang on to Berkshire because he didn't want to give them the impression that the partnership was just sort of transferring to Berkshire. And, you know, he didn't want to disappoint them. But no, I think he just sort of like stumbled upon this. And, you know, the story, of course, why he bought Berkshire was just a cigar butt situation. He bought in, he knew that they would do these share buybacks. And I think it was like, he goes down to talk to the management. The management's like, okay, Warren, we're going to do a share buyback for what, 12 and a quarter, I think. And the share buyback comes in and it's like 12 and an eighth. And so Buffett gets pissed off and he just starts buying the stock. And you know, all of a sudden it's like he's got this big position in Berkshire Hathaway. And then I think it was kind of like, oh, I have this. Well, now what do I do? And he just sort of made the best of a bad situation. And of course, Charlie Munger helped with that. So, you know, was Berkshire by design? No, I don't think so. I think he just sort of like had this. And now it's like, okay, we got to make the best of a bad situation.
Yeah. And do you think he intended, so he says that I'm going to basically not be as active of an investor. I'm not going to be as focused on this. He's like, I want to kind of focus on other things. Like he really sounds like he's retiring, but that didn't really happen. Do you think like he intended to like really retire and kind of be done with money management completely? Or do you think he had it in the back of his mind that like, I'm just going to I might slow down a little bit, but this isn't over.
I think it was just ratcheting down expectations is what I think it was. Like, you know, Buffett, it's pretty clear by that point that it's like, this is what he does, and he was going to keep doing it. But the interesting thing is that if he would have, okay, like, I'm done with money management, like, why not sell your Berkshire Hathaway? Like, even if you take a small loss on it, or you just do it for a few years, and then it's like, okay, like, I've got this vehicle. It's, you know, I can sell it. You sell it to Munger, or sell it to you know, like someone else in the Buffett group. So I think that he intended for Berkshire Hathaway to be this kind of this vehicle, because if he didn't, like why have it? Like, why go to the inefficiency of having this publicly traded company when you can just sort of sit in a room in Omaha and you know, invest from there and continue to do the things that he wanted to do. You know, he wanted to be more involved in boards and the, you know, like, kind of that type of thing. So I think it was definitely sort of an on purpose kind of thing. I think he had Berkshire Hathaway, and he's like, okay, now that I have this, I'm going to turn it around and turn it into this great, great vehicle and let people invest alongside me. But of course, he never really encouraged anyone to invest alongside him. It's just kind of like, hey, I have this thing, and if you want to invest in it, great, but I'm not going to ask you to.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, one of the things I've gathered from that I'm impressed with by Warren's life is the way that he avoids so many financial scandals and fads. So he doesn't get sucked up into the Nifty 50 craze of the early 1970s. He doesn't become a corporate raider in the 1980s. It would have been very easy for him to do that and basically make easy money, but make a lot of enemies. He's approached about long-term capital management, and these are like PhDs and some of the most impressive investors in the world. And he says, no, thanks. He doesn't get swept up in the internet bubble. So why do you think how do you think he has such a good nose for this? Like, he is so adept at avoiding the fads of his day. Like, how do you think he's able to accomplish that?
I think that the number one underrated Buffett quality that nobody talks about is his discipline. He is one of the reasons why he is the best ever is because he's one of the most disciplined ever. He's willing to, you know, when he made the investment in Bank of America in 2008, I remember him saying that he had read every Bank of America annual report since like 1958 or something. It was like 50 years of reading every Bank of America annual report, and he did nothing for 50 years and then was able to strike when the opportunity came along. And, you know, especially nowadays with you know, Robinhood and Wealthsimple up here in Canada, and, you know, the ability to buy, you know, fractional shares and no cost of trading and whatever, it's just the discipline was incredible. He would just let cash accumulate. You let cash accumulate for years sometimes. I mean now it's 2024. When was the last time Buffett made a significant stock purchase? Like Apple in the you know, 2010s? Like, the patience and the discipline is astounding. And he's just able to let these trends go by and just sort of watch them in a way that I don't think many other investors in the history of investing are able to do. And nobody talks about that quality with Buffett. They just sort of, you know, it's like, hey, look, he's the greatest. Well, part of the reason why he's the greatest, big part of the reason why he's the greatest, is that he's willing to wait for years for for these fat pitches.
Yeah, and he's willing to not get swept up in the fads of his day. It's definitely a very admirable quality. So I think another key to his success is his relationships with people. So he really, I think maybe after what he went through with in the 1960s with or 1970s with his family, it's something that he really focuses on, and he really focuses on good friendships and relationships with people. How important do you think that is to his success?
Oh, it's also massive, because when you're waiting for the fat pitch, it's easy to just kind of get bored or frustrated or whatever, and just sort of make a decision that is suboptimal. So the fact that he, you know, he has as friends who he plays bridge with, and, you know, he spends time with Bill Gates, and him and Bill Gates kind of debate, you know, you can just imagine the high level conversations that they were having. I think that helps him stay grounded and stay patient, but it also kind of expands his knowledge. And you know, there's no kind of doubt that Buffett, he's got these friends, and it's like they're compartmentalized in terms of, you know, Bill Gates is you know, like Bill Gates' friend. He's got his friend who he played bridge with. And then he had Carol Loomis, who was kind of like the, you know, would do the partnership letter or the Berkshire letter with him every year. And so these relationships, I think, kind of distract him from investing, but also give him something else to do that isn't just kind of sitting on his hands and thinking, I gotta trade something. I gotta invest in something. I have to they allow him to be patient.
Absolutely. Another admirable trait of Buffett, I think, is that he doesn't get swept up in lifestyle inflation. So as the richest man in the world, most people get really into that. Like they're dramatically expanding their lifestyle. Warren Buffett maintained an extremely simple lifestyle for a long time. He still lives in the same house he bought in the 1950s. In the 60s, he was a very rich man, and he was, I think, driving around in a Volkswagen Beetle. And he's well known for having simple tastes. Like he likes Coca-Cola, he likes fast food, he likes his restaurants. But most billionaires that you hear about are getting, you know, basically out of control with their spending. Like I think Jeff Bezos is probably the anti Warren Buffett at this point, with the way that he lives, with it, you know, the biggest yacht in the world and mansions and blah blah blah. So how do you think he's been able to resist that pull of lifestyle inflation?
I think that there are a lot of people who, if you ask them, their goal is to be the richest person in the world or to be a rich person. But I think for most people, they want to be rich because, like, you know, it's like they don't want to be a millionaire to have $1 million. They want to be a millionaire because they want to spend $1 million. And Buffett was never kind of influenced by that. He wanted to be the richest person in the world, but I think it was just like that was his inner scorecard thing, where it's like money represented in his world. It's like money is kind of like the scorecard. And, you know, it's like, if you can have the most amount of money, well then people kind of respect you. And so for him, it was the intellectual pursuit of the journey and the goal and kind of working towards something. It was never the sort of trappings of a rich man's lifestyle. You know, he does fly private, which he took great kind of pains to sort of kind of rationalize to people. And he, you know, made fun of himself a lot when he first got the plane. But other than that, like his lifestyle is no different than like my lifestyle or your lifestyle, in terms of like, that's the only thing that's different, is that he flies private. He also can phone up anyone he wants and kind of, you know, get them to return his call, where, you know, if I phone Bill Gates, he's not returning my call. But just in terms of, you know, the consumer part, he just really didn't care about any of that. My favorite story of his thriftiness is, it's in the early 2000s. It's in the book, and he needs a new Cadillac. He buys a new Cadillac like every 3 years, and of course trades the old one in or whatever. But he makes Susie Jr. go to like every Cadillac, you know, every like dealership within like 100-mile radius to find the cheapest one. And he ends up buying one with hail damage. And so it's like, at this point, like, he's a billionaire. Like, I don't know what he's worth at this point, like $20, $30 billion or whatever. And he's like, send his daughter out so he can save $5,000 on a car that has hail damage. Like, just that kind of stuff. Like, it boggles a lot of people's minds, but I find it just incredibly refreshing that it's like, here's a man who appreciates the dollar to the point where he's looking for a hail damaged car.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things I've heard him say at one of the meetings was that as you kind of expand your lifestyle, it's almost the net negative that I've heard. I heard him say this, like, if I owned 5 houses, he said that would retract from my lifestyle. That would be a bad thing for my lifestyle. And I just think it's cool that he has that kind of perspective. And I think it's something we can apply to our own lives. Like, you know, as you accumulate unnecessary stuff, it's a net negative for your life.
Oh, for sure. And of course, Buffett did have other houses, but of course, Susie had these other houses. And, you know, they had a vacation home in Laguna Beach in California, but that was a Susie thing. And as soon as Susie, you know, passed away, kind of these assets were sold, and Buffett very much kind of shrunk, you know, kind of these things. Exactly what you said is that he felt it detracted from his lifestyle. I know me personally, it's like I travel a fair bit and everything, but it's like, it's just so much easier to, I say it's rent your fun, where it's like, you just show up somewhere, you pay for a hotel, you know, you pay for Ubers to drive you around, and then you just leave. And it's so much easier to do that rather than be like, okay, I'm going to buy a place, you know, here. I have to make sure it gets maintained. I have to make sure like nobody breaks in. Someone has to manage it. And it's just so much simpler to just show up, rent, and then leave than owning something that someone has to take care of. And it takes up bandwidth in your brain. That Buffett was exceptionally good at sort of, if something was taking up bandwidth in his brain and it wasn't value to him, of just cutting that out and, you know, using the bathtub memory, as the book talks about so much, and just kind of, you know, extracting this from his brain and never thinking of it again.
Yeah, absolutely. And the things and the luxuries he does have, they're necessities. Like, I think the jet is a necessity for him. Like, first of all, he's such a celebrity. He can't just walk around in an airport like you or I could. He's going to be harassed for autographs and people trying to talk to him. And he, you know, to get around to other companies and to really move around the country, I think he needs that private jet. He can't like waste time like we can, spending, you know, 4 hours dealing with the TSA and everything else. I definitely think even that jet, as extraordinary as it is, it's a necessity for his life.
And not only that, but Buffett paid himself $100,000 a year to run Berkshire from, I think, like the 1980s to today. So, yes, you know, he does cost Berkshire money in terms of the private jet, but not only have they more than made it up with the, you know, like if Buffett was being paid a traditional salary to run Berkshire, it would be tens of millions of dollars every year. Like, that's what it costs for a CEO of a major corporation. So he saved the money that way. And of course, nobody can argue with Berkshire's long-term results. So it's like he has this private jet, but he still works incredibly cheaply for Berkshire shareholders.
Yep, I totally agree. And I think another good quality of Warren Buffett is that he's constantly learning, and he seems to be constantly evolving and staying attuned to the issues of the day. Like, a lot of times people get older and they just kind of get stuck in, this is how I see the world, and they never change it. But Warren Buffett, he seems just so dynamic. He's always learning new things. He can always talk extensively about whatever is going on right now. Like, you might disagree, for instance, like you might disagree with his position about Bitcoin, but I think he's pretty well informed about it. Like, he'll be able to have an intelligent conversation with you. I don't think you could have an intelligent conversation about Bitcoin with most people in their 90s. Like, what do you think about that aspect of him?
I mean, from all the reports I've heard, is that the man is in his 90s and he's still plowing through newspapers every day. He's still reading books. He's still reading annual reports. The guy just continues to learn in his 90s. And like you said, like, there are very, very few people in their, even their 60s or 50s, who are willing to get books on things they don't understand and learn about them. And just a learning machine for 70 years, 80 years, that's going to pay dividends over time. And the fact that he is in his old age still clearly learning things is remarkable. And it's another one of the things that just makes him so special.
Yeah, I totally agree. Now, you know, what do you think? So, you know, wrapping this up, like, what do you think what are the chief things that you have taken away from this book? Like, for the average person who is not a billionaire or have ambitions to be a billionaire, what are the big lessons you think you can take from Warren Buffett's life and apply it to your own?
Sure. I'm going to narrow it down to two words, is focus and discipline, where Buffett's entire life was dedicated to becoming the richest man in the world. And he was focused on only that to the detriment of his kids, his marriage, you know, relationships. He cared about that stuff, but it took a backseat to his overarching desire to be the richest man in the world. And that's something that I think a lot of people can learn from, because I don't think focus is a major driver for a lot of people. And I'm not saying that you know, my advice is that everyone should ignore their family in terms of being rich, but perhaps a little bit more focus on your goals is an important thing. And in terms of discipline, that for me was the biggest kind of takeaway from the book, where it's it seemed like every time that Buffett sort of went into something that he was just kind of like, well, I don't know, but, you know, he kind of like talked himself into it. It didn't work out, you know, in terms of there's stories about the Consolidated Retail Company, which him and Munger and another guy started in the 1970s. And like, that was a bit of a swing and a miss. Solomon Brothers in the 1990s, like that was a swing and a miss. And those are two kind of investments that Buffett sort of talked himself into. So that discipline just wasn't there. And I just look at him as a, you know, today he's, you know, in his 80s and his 90s. And he continues to be incredibly patient and wait for that fat pitch. And I mean, his legacy is important to him. And it would be easy for a lesser man to kind of, hey, I'm 94 years old. I know that I don't have that many years left. I'm going to start swinging for the fences in terms of trying to grow Berkshire and do like the biggest company in the world. And he doesn't do that. He just sits in Omaha and reads and is patient and is willing to wait. And I think that's a lesson that I took from it, and that I needed to learn and be a little bit more, you know, diligent at. And I think it's something that people listening to can really take from Buffett. And it's something that they forget about Buffett a lot too.
Yeah, that's a good takeaway. I definitely agree about the focus and discipline part, because we live in a time when I think so many people are more focused on multitasking, on trying to do a million things well, and they wind up doing everything kind of poorly. And anytime you read about Buffett, and really anytime you read about any very successful person, they are very focused on this thing. Like, this is my priority. This is my goal. This is what I'm trying to do. And like you mentioned, family and stuff, like for some people, it might be the family is the focus of their mm-hmm. life, you know? And I think whatever in life, one of the big lessons you can pick up from this is you got to figure out what's important to you and focus on it. Like, you're a human being with limited bandwidth. You can't just do 100 things well. You got to figure out your priorities.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, one of the things that when I talk to young people and they ask my advice, one of the things I've said is like, you know, think about one word that describes you. And it might be, you know, mother, it might be father, it might be, you know, if you're a teacher, it might be teacher. You know, think about that one word that describes you and make that the focus of your life. And that word might be uncomfortable. That word might not be your career where you're at, but just figure out your word and kind of do what you can to make sure that word is the most important thing in your life. And Buffett clearly understood this from a young age, and his word was definitely investor. And that was his focus, and he was unapologetic about it. So yeah, I think that's an important lesson to take from this as well.
Absolutely. Now, are there any other topics you want to talk about with this book or Warren Buffett's life?
I think we covered a lot of it. It is a thick, thick book.
Yeah.
But it reads really well. Like it doesn't feel like a thick book. It's not a hard read at all. It's entertaining. There's some great stories from Buffett's life. If you haven't read the book, I mean, you know, read it now. Like it's one of the great biographies of one of the great men, and you'll learn a ton and you'll be entertained as well. And I'm just holding out hope for hopefully Alice Schroeder. Alice, if you're listening, please get to work on a updated version if you haven't already, because I would love to read that.
Me too. That sounds great. Well, I think it's a great place to leave off. Well, thank you for coming on today. I really enjoyed this conversation.
I'm always a big fan of the Value Stock Geek podcast, and my third time on. Always.
Yeah, you're the most prolific guest. So I haven't had anyone on three times. So you're definitely the champion.
I will hold this title forever. I don't care who you have on afterwards and how many times they come on. I will always be the champion. I'm going to tell everyone that. No. It's always a pleasure. I have a lot of fun with these. And anytime you want to invite me on again, I'm happy to show up.
Awesome. Well, thanks for your time and have a good day.
Yeah, you too.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. For more information, please go to securityanalysis.org. Subscribers to the website get early ad-free access to podcast episodes in addition to weekly in-depth profiles of companies.